Hi and welcome to the CDC Insight podcast. CDC is the UK's development finance institution and impact investor. And in this podcast episode, we're sharing some of the highlights from one of our recent Insight events. These events share practical lessons on private sector investment and development based on our experiences, knowledge, and research. Now today, we're exploring the role of global governance in the long economic recovery from the coronavirus pandemic, and how international cooperation, trade, and investment can help developing economies in the process. Our guest for this episode is one of the leading voices in global governance, Professor Nari Woods from the Blavatnik School at the University of Oxford. And Professor Woods is joined on the panel by Vivian Infante, who provides some additional perspective of working directly with businesses on the African continent during the crisis. But before we hear from them both, let me introduce you to your host, Colin Buckley, CDC's General Counsel and Head of External Relations.
COVID is increasingly being recognized as potentially one of the most disruptive events of our generation. And what started as a devastating health crisis has tested long-established governance structures and exposed massive societal imbalances. It now seems that once again, it will be developing countries that bear the brunt of the consequences, especially economically, where an estimated 100 million people may be pushed back into extreme poverty. The tools for recovery may remain the same: fiscal and monetary policy, trade and investment promotion, global governance aimed at equitable burden. But how we use those tools requires substantial change if we are to escape an outcome where the most vulnerable once again pay the highest price. Joining us today is Oxford University's governance and international development expert, Professor Nari Woods. Professor Woods is Dean of the Blavatnik School of Government and Professor of Global Economic Governance at Oxford University. Professor Woods has published extensively, and her research focuses on global development, the challenges of globalization, and especially how to enhance the governance of international organizations. So, Nari, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Good morning, Colin, and good morning, everyone.
So let's jump in on the COVID crisis, which is certainly the issue of the moment. I mean, you've spent a lot of time looking at existing governance structures, and clearly COVID has challenged the resilience of those structures. I mean, what are your reflections on this extraordinary year?
So Colin, well, a first thing to say is that before this pandemic, the world had engaged in a series of exercises to test pandemic preparedness: the joint external evaluations of the World Bank, the Epidemic Preparedness Index prepared by scholars, the Global Health Security Index created by the Gates Foundation and others. And the first thing we learned is that there was something missing from those indices, that those indices, the Global Health Security Index, in the lead put Britain and the United States as the most pandemic prepared countries in the world. And yet their performance in managing the pandemic has not been top of class. So I think the first thing is that means we've really got to think about what was missing. And part of what was missing was some lessons about governance. And I think what I would highlight is that this health crisis is not like the financial crisis. That in a financial crisis, the central government can sit and orchestrate a solution. But the first thing that we've learned in this health crisis is that government needs to be able to shape everybody's behavior. And that requires a trust in government and in the likelihood that what government is telling you to do when they say, stay home, don't go to work, put your family at risk from starvation, is likely to succeed. For me, the governance lesson that we never addressed in all the pandemic preparedness stuff was about the connectivity between central government and local communities. And that means not just some kind of vague connectivity, but do they actually share data? Do they share decision-making, and do they share resources? And what we've seen in the response to COVID is that governments that have tried to govern from the center alone have not done very well. that they need to work hand in hand, and that there's a connectivity gap in lots of countries where we need to rebuild the capacity of local communities and the central government to actually work together in a relationship of trust. And then I guess a final reflection would be about the global level, that we've been reminded that strategic competition between the United States, China, their various allies, Europe, it cannot be permitted to eviscerate international cooperation. That we might have all kinds of differences about what's going on in each other's countries. There can be very sharp debates, perfectly well, you know, grounded and understood debates, but there are times when we have to put those differences and grievances aside and focus on international cooperation, because there are some issues that no country can deal with on its own, like managing the pandemic, like averting the financial crisis, which is now hard upon us and which we'll talk about some more, and like dealing with climate change. And if we don't deal with those three issues cooperatively, there will be many millions more people who suffer really terribly.
I mean, one of the interesting parts of what you say, if I can take it the next step, is it potentially the shared COVID experience may have affected what we think a good governance system is, and what we think good political institutions and good organizational institutions are. I mean, it may have fundamentally changed the type of governance that we want.
I think we've come through a couple of decades of thinking about governance in with too much of a focus on economic policy and thinking about economic policy instruments. And before COVID, we saw a backlash against that in the kind of rise of what people like to call populism, a cry from a majority of people in so many countries, from Brazil to the United States, Germany, the United Kingdom, across parts of Africa, a cry of people saying, your system, you, the governing elite, your system doesn't work for us. So already we had seen a kind of popular versus government approach begin. And I think what we've now seen in the pandemic is we've seen that there are all kinds of reasons why we now have to think transformatively again. We're at a really conjunctural point where before COVID, you know, some would say that capitalism was being re-questioned, and now the very legitimacy of government is being tested. So there is a route out of this. There is a route forward that helps us resolve both sides of that. And that's going to require really serious leadership from the CDC, from everybody.
Yeah. So I think many would say that on the test of the pandemic, governance has maybe got a failing grade, maybe got at best a very mediocre grade. But let's test it on the economic side, because really what you're suggesting is really that's where they should do well. And clearly we're heading towards another global financial crisis. And as we look ahead to that, and one that is not over a crisis in the West, but also acutely felt in the developing world, I mean, what approach should governments be taking to their national recoveries?
Yeah, so here we've really, you know, and by the way, I don't think COVID's been a fail grade on all governance. I think what's truly interesting, and here at the Blavatnik School, we've been tracking government responses across the world week by week. What's interesting is to look at the things that have worked as well and the countries that have worked. And my point about the pandemic preparedness index is that there have been surprises in that. You know, who would have thought in the first 6 months of COVID that Senegal would do better than Britain in testing and tracing and isolating? So I think there's lots to learn that's positive there. I think the debt crisis is absolutely deserves our kind of fullmost attention. You said, what is it that governments need to do economically? And I think already we've seen a debate across the wealthy world about whether to grab the investment playbook or the austerity playbook. With the IMF, the OECD, and others saying, look, please grab the investment playbook. Don't do this like you've done financial crises. And that's hard for treasuries and finance ministries around the world, because they only really know the austerity playbook. So that's one challenge. And some of the expertise that CDC and others have needs now to be brought back to the wealthy countries. If you want to invest, here's how you can do it. But I think for developing and emerging economies that, don't really have that luxury to stay, to say, will we choose in this low interest rate environment to invest? Because they will not be able to invest unless there's the right international cooperation. And I think that's absolutely critical. Coming before COVID, developing and emerging economies had already radically increased their debt. So they came into this crisis indebted. Now we've seen them become much more indebted. And there's only, you know, if you can't grow out of a debt crisis, and all the projections look to tell us that there is not going to be an immediate growth path out of this crisis, there's only three ways to solve this problem. There's only three instruments we can use to solve the debt crisis. We can require countries to adjust. We can't do that at the moment because they can't grow out of it, and they've got to contain the pandemic, not just for their own populations, but for our own populations. So adjustment's very difficult. And that only leaves us with two tools. And one is new finance, and the other is restructuring the debt. Now, those two become really interesting. New financing is crucial, but what we're seeing in the international realm at the moment is a real reluctance to sweat the international institutions that we've got. In other words, to say, look, we pulled our credit in the IMF and World Bank. We have the capacity globally to deal with this crisis. Instead, we're seeing still a lot of risk aversion on the part of the major creditor shareholders in those institutions to say, well, hold on, let's use our business as usual instruments, which tend to be slow and tend to be pro-cyclical and tend to channel financing only to donor darlings and leave out a whole lot of countries. So we've got to now address those problems. We've got to get finance to countries that don't already have IMF and World Bank programs. And that means sweating the way we do these loans. We've got to work counter-cyclically. We've got to say, in this downturn, rather than trying to be risk averse with the World Bank and IMF balance sheets, we need to sweat those balance sheets. And don't forget that if we oversweat those balance sheets, and really test them, the risk falls onto the wealthy countries who are the major guarantors of those institutions. And that's a risk they should be prepared to shoulder at the moment. The international business chamber have come up with some, you know, really extraordinary predictions of just how much cheaper it is for us to act now rather than to wait and act later. For business and for the governments of the wealthy countries, it's 10, 20, 50, and even on one calculation, 100-fold more expensive to keep waiting, to keep our risk aversion until crisis pushes us into a crisis measure. And then on restructuring, I mean, we can pick it up if you'd like. I think it's absolutely vital. Restructuring is really difficult. We've gone through so many debates at the international level about how do we restructure debt when we just know it's not sustainable, when we know a country's never really going to be able to repay its debt. What do we actually do? We've seen collective action clauses. We've seen attempts to set up a bankruptcy mechanism at the international, which failed. But now, having not found those solutions, we've got a real problem because we've got a very diversified set of debt holders. It's not just bonds anymore. It's all kinds of new instruments, which we can't corral into one place. We've got official donors like China and Saudi Arabia, who are not part of the Paris Club, who we have to include in debt restructuring conversations.
And I'm just curious how, just trying to connect this to private sector development, as you identified, the debt challenge this time around is fundamentally different in that it is not only government to government, and not only sort of established multilateral institutions and governments. And there's been much in the press about the worries of investors have about the debt crisis. I mean, what can we tell private investors who've already left the developing country in the early days of COVID that it's okay to come back in Is there anything that we can tell them about debt that would isolate that risk from them?
Well, the first thing I would say is that all the international actors have been clear that they're not going to force private sector investors into debt restructuring. And in the past, there's very little record of them doing that. I mean, the cases where they have, the exceptions that stick out in people's minds. But actually, you know, for many people, there's never been enough of that. And that it's very much the debt that's already gone in, not the new debt. So they actually, if you look at the history of sovereign debt restructuring, it's not a history of new investors going in, being stripped of rights. I'm sorry, that doesn't sound hugely optimistic, but it's just to point out that there are some fears which are not borne out by the historic evidence. So it's to say, you know, we really need to build a trusted framework so that new money can go in. And I think that there is, even at the height of US and China shouting at one another, we saw them come together in the G20 and cooperate on debt restructuring, on debt suspension from the official sector to the poorest countries of the world. If they can cooperate even at that moment, that cooperation can be nurtured and can continue. And with a cooperative framework in place, I think new investment can be relatively secure in going in. Problem is, you know, do they have the project ready to invest in, I guess, Colin? Would be a question to you.
That's another question we've spoken about at some of these events. And finally, the final question before we open up to bring in Vivian. But I can't resist the opportunity, given your background in institutional governance. And we've spoken a lot about the role that multilateral organizations played. We've alluded to the IMF. I mean, we could the World Bank and so forth. But increasingly, there seems to be a rise in the role of bilateral institutions like CDC here in the UK. But, you know, the resurrection of the American DFI was much trumpeted in the press. Chinese now have sort of DFI equivalents. What do you make of this kind of rise of the bilateral institution?
Look, there are some real advantages to bilateral institutions. It was a great surprise to me a decade ago when work was done looking at the volatility of aid and investment, where I expected the multilaterals to be less volatile. For some reason, I thought that they might be the folks staying the course, when in fact, the reverse was true. It turned out that bilateral flows were more stable. And that's pretty important to long-term, to the kinds of long-term infrastructure and other investments that are going to enable growth in these countries. But I think the cost of the proliferation of bilateral agencies is the transactions cost in each country. You know, all of us who have sat in Dar es Salaam or Kampala or Accra, you know, or Lagos or Abuja have noted that we very quickly realize that there's a very small team in the finance ministry or planning who are trying to orchestrate typically 2,000 or 3,000 different external financing institutions. And that it cannot be that governments simply become the middlemen and middlewomen of bilateral aid agencies. You know, if there's one lesson from development assistance of the last 30 years is that ownership is everything, that it's so important for a government to be supported and coached and helped to come up with its own strategy. And it's into that strategy that bilaterals need to play.
And now I'd like to introduce Vivian Infante, who is CDC's country director for Ethiopia. And in addition to Ethiopia, Vivian has worked for CDC in DRC. And before joining us, she worked in Nigeria. So welcome, Vivian.
Thank you.
So I know that you've been listening to Neri's comments with interest. I mean, from sitting in Addis, this ongoing uncertainty around COVID and governance and debt and heightened investor anxiety. How does this feel from the vantage point of Addis in Ethiopia?
Yes, I think it's key to recognize that this pandemic has not manifested equally for all countries, both in terms of infections as well as the way we can afford to have or not have a lockdown. So here in Ethiopia, the government said from the beginning, listen, we cannot afford a lockdown. We work for our daily wages. And so we will have to learn to maneuver the health risks in a way that allows us to earn a living. And this applies to a multitude of African nations. So right now out there, it's a normal day of operations in Ethiopia. There's a lot of traffic in a way that many European nations have not seen in probably a year or so. So I'm not saying necessarily this is a good thing, but the country has had to learn to live with the risk in a more active way. So then Professor Woods has talked about the outstanding performance of countries that were not necessarily in our radars as potential star performers in the pandemic. And we sometimes forget that many African nations like Ethiopia or Nigeria are very used to cycles and crises more than developed economies. So crisis is unfortunately almost ingrained in people's ways of lives, and there's an inherent resilience in developing countries as a result. And it just reminds me of the example of Ethiopian Airlines. I think by May or June last year, there was a lot of panic about Ethiopian Airlines, which is a fantastic airline, the best in the continent. And the rumors were that it was losing, just in the first quarter last year, about $1 billion. But the incredible business resilience that this airline has demonstrated, they basically turned passenger airplanes into cargo very quickly, or they were flying to London half cargo, half with people, and they were reinventing their business to do charter flights for governments to transport their citizens. So I guess shutting down was a luxury that Ethiopian Airlines cannot afford. And equally, my counterpart, Benson Adenuga in Nigeria, was talking about how people are so surprised that Nigerian banks are doing very well. And he's just basically telling, you know, some of those comments, well, this is the way we have learned to operate, and Nigerian banks have got very good balance sheets that have been built crisis after crisis. So this is this kind of modus operandi for us. So I guess Professor Woods is right in triggering an introspective about what lessons actually can we learn from those nations which have been in some respect able to withstand a wild ride that this pandemic has brought for us all. And just one last word about debt, since Professor Woods also mentioned it. It has been actually a sobering lesson to learn about the way Ethiopia just recently called for a restructuring of its debt, and many investors panicked. But in the end, the IMF raised its hand and said, actually, it is very good that Ethiopia has done this. It is well within the current IMF program in which Ethiopia is operating, and it puts Ethiopia in a better position to satisfy its obligations and also attract foreign investment. So that initial panic proved to be an exaggeration, and I have to admit a little bit of ignorance from my part.
So thank you very much for listening to this CDC Insight podcast. If you like this selection of highlights, then the full recording is available on our YouTube channel. You can find a link to it in the show notes for this episode. And if you want to stay up to date with all of the news, events, reports, and podcasts from the CDC Insight program, then please do also sign up to the newsletter. Again, there's a link for you in the show notes for that one as well. That's pretty much it then for today. Thank you again to Nari Woods, Vivian Infante, and Colin Buckley for today's podcast. We'll be back again with a new episode in a couple of weeks' time. See you soon.